Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamarais.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.
Did you know that 70% of all books, including those traditionally published, are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand and build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Ever wonder why so many authors publish books and later say that they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and we see it all over social media. Authors think it's a them problem, but not always. They just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I've helped clients launch client books to the bestseller list for 15 years and have built a 6-module, 11-hour course with all of my knowledge that will give you the craft and book business information that you simply won't find anywhere else. And there's an app plus monthly Q&A sessions with me. 200 of you have already joined my new course. And as writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. If you want the info that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15, that's POD15 at checkout. That's POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course. I'll see you there.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency.
All right, guys, so we have some really exciting changes coming to the show we want to tell you about. So after 4 amazing years of bringing you so much content for the show, we're switching up the format. I don't want to alarm you, we're not going anywhere, but we're going to switch up the format just a little bit. So what does this mean for you guys? 1 week, we're going to be doing our Books with Hooks segment, which, as you guys know, is the query segment. And then the next week, we are going to dive in depth into the author interview. So it's a rhythm that's going to let us deliver quality content for you guys and just give us a bit more space and time to create it. Life and work is really busy for all of us. We got a lot going on behind the scenes with our jobs and Bianca's writing. And this new format is really just about sustainability for us so we can continue to bring you guys the best of what we have to offer for many more months and episodes to come. So don't worry, we are not going anywhere. In fact, we're actually doubling down on our newsletter content. So you can expect lots of great exclusive content, all the sneak peeks, bonus goodies, all of that delivered straight to your inbox in Substack. If you haven't already, make sure that you are signed up for our Substack. And of course, we would love it if you could support us financially. Please become a paid subscriber to consume all the content that you guys love. And if you are a paid subscriber, that's going to earn you one more newsletter a week, which is great. So we're so grateful for all of your support for the past 4 years. We're so excited about the new chapter of the show. So stick with us as we evolve many more years of learning, writing, and creating together. So thank you. And I will throw it back to Bianca.
Today's guest is a writer of Mi'kmaq and settler ancestry. Her debut novel, The Berry Pickers, was critically acclaimed bestseller in Canada, won the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction and the Barnes & Noble Discover Prize, and was a finalist for the Atwood Gibson Writers' Trust Fiction Prize. She has a certificate in creative writing from the University of Toronto and is a graduate of the Master of Fine Arts program at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. She lives and writes in the Annapolis Valley, Nova Scotia, with her fur babies, Holly and Puck. It's my pleasure to welcome Amanda Peters. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's so wonderful to have you. And just for our listeners, it is such an incredibly small world. So in 2014, I was also studying as a student at the University of Toronto, and I decided to sign up for a sort of course that they had during the International Festival of Authors. And they had in some really amazing authors who we got to learn from, and they were interviewed in front of us, etc. And I met Amanda, somewhere through the International Festival of Authors and through the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies program. And this is why 10 years later, when this book landed on my desk, I was going, Amanda Peters, where do I know this name from? And then I was like, oh my God, Amanda, I remember Amanda from my course. So the literary community in Toronto is particularly small, but certainly all over the world. And had you told Amanda and I sort of 10 years ago, while we were both trying to become published authors, that I would be interviewing her one day on my podcast as a published author and she would be a published author, I think we both would, well, we would have hoped to believe it, but I know I certainly would have freaked out. I'm not sure about you, Amanda.
Yeah, I wouldn't have believed it in a million years, to be honest, because I'm just still overwhelmed by everything that's been happening. So yeah, it's kind of crazy 10 years later.
It's amazing to see your incredible, incredible success. So the book that we're discussing today is a collection of short stories. I specifically wanted to cover short stories, not just because of Amanda, but because we don't cover them all that often on the podcast, purely because it's so difficult to get a collection of short stories published. You know, generally big publishers are not into them, and so we don't get them pitched to us all that often. So I am going to read you the flap copy. The book that we're discussing today is Waiting for the Long Night Moon. Here is our flap copy. Her debut collection of short fiction, award-winning and critically acclaimed author Amanda Peters describes the Indigenous experience from an astonishingly wide spectrum in time and place, from contact with the first European settlers to the forced removal of Indigenous children to the present-day fight for the right to clean water. In this intimate collection, Peters melds traditional storytelling with beautiful spare prose to describe the dignity of the traditional way of life, the humiliations of systemic racism, and the resilient power to endure. A young man returns from residential school only to realize he can no longer communicate with his own parents. A young woman finds purpose and healing on the front lines as a water protector. An old man remembers his life as he patiently waits for death. And a young girl nervously dances in her first, okay, I'm going to mess up that pronunciation, Amanda.
Maliomi.
There we go. At times sad, sometimes disturbing, but always redemptive, the stories in Waiting for the Long Night Moon will remind you that where there is grief, there is also joy. Where there is trauma, there is resilience. And most importantly, there is power. Right. So much to unpack from this sort of masterclass in short story writing. I'm going to ask Amanda if she can kick us off by reading us the first short story in the collection.
Okay, no problem. The first short story in the collection is called Bagaboog or Winter Arrives. And the reason it's the first short story is it is my first short story I ever really wrote and the first one that was ever published. And I believe I wrote it, part of it, at IFOA. So here we go. The pale ones have returned, their skin the dull pink of early sun on snow. There are more this time, many more. Their clothes are too heavy for the season, thick and rough. Only their faces and hands see the sun. They've been here before, and they have departed before. We have watched them, nervous of the cold, not willing to risk the quiet of winter. Yesterday, after the fish had been set to dry in the sun, and when no one would notice my absence, I ran along the river's edge, ducking in and out of the trees so that I could watch them. They don't know we are here, but we know about them. They have been coming for two seasons now. They arrive in large, strange canoes, but they always leave. Some of them die. They cover their dead with earth and wail, scaring some of the smaller children who hear their voices through the trees. More women arrive this time, and children, some younger than me. The children run around like animals shouting at each other. Their harsh language is uncomfortable in my ears. Their playful shrieks are louder than the birds who try to steal our fish. Their mothers shout at them, their mouths in constant frowns, their hands raised to wipe the sweat from their brows. The women drag water from the river, the bottom of their dresses wet with mud. The buckets look heavy, bending their backs. They smile very little, these pale ones. I wonder it's the heavy clothes and the stiff shoes that make them bad-tempered. The men sweat in the sun as they move large stones from the shore and cut the trees from the earth one by one. The earth on their side of the river is bare now. The stumps from the trees jagged and ugly. Dirt fills the air as they walk. Their feet pound the ground in their stiff shoes. With the stones and the trees, they build strange dwellings. There's little sense in their work, as it will be difficult to move them to the summer grounds when the seasons change. They have brought a funny thing, not made of trees or stone. It looks like a wilting flower. It sat on the ground for days, the morning dew sliding off the top, running down the side and wetting the ground in a beautiful circle of dark earth. But now it sits high atop of a special dwelling, hanging in an open space above the entrance. No one lives there, but everyone visits, all of them looking very grim, their heads bent, their eyes on their shoes. When the red-faced man in the black robe pulls the rope, it sings. The sound is steady and beautiful like a drum, only sadder. How can they be so sad with such magic in the air, echoing off the trees, the river, the sky itself? Father is not worried about the pale face. He tells us they will leave. They have come before, and they will leave again. When they see their breath on the morning air, they will leave, he explained around the fire last night. I shook my head as I watched the sparks from the fire climb to take their rightful place in the sky. But they brought children, they made homes, and brought a magic flower that sings like a drum. Maybe they will stay this time. They will not. Each year they come, little one. They come and they leave. They will leave their homes and their wilting flower. Father is sure, but I'm not. I think they may stay.
Awesome, Amanda. Thank you so much. So for our listeners, this really is, it was an incredibly short story. It's just a few pages long, but truly a masterclass in framing and point of view. So every single description is from that character's frame of reference in terms of their life experience, in terms of their own world and what they know about their own world, in terms of these other people and what they know about these other people's world, right? So just the description of a bell, how that person would perceive it, their description of a building, but nobody stays there. So can we speak a bit about the importance of point of view and framing when it comes to writing this kind of story, Amanda?
So far, all of my writing, actually, published writing, has been in first-person point of view. And I did this deliberately because I wanted people to feel like they were sitting down and speaking with somebody and listening to a story. Like if you're sitting around the campfire and listening to this child tell you the story of this crazy bell thing that looked like a wilting flower, that you would feel that you were in conversation with them. So I think it's really important. And I know there are limitations to first-person point of view because you can't see other people's perspectives. But I think it's important, especially when we're talking about Indigenous stories, that you see that character's perspective, because for far too long, the perspective has been someone else's perceiving Indigenous people, and we don't want to do that anymore. So it was a conscious decision on my part for my book, my novel, The Berry Pickers, and this collection, to write it in first person point of view so that you get the perspective of that Indigenous person telling the story.
Yeah, but even the framing of every single thing, the way they view the world, when you sit down to decide who the narrator of the story is, who this I is, I don't think that in the piece we establish whether it's a girl or a boy, and I think you do that on purpose because it obviously doesn't matter. We kind of get the gist that it is a child. We don't know how old the child is from the context between the conversation between the child and the father. So when you sit down, you have it very clear in your mind who this character is, what their frame of reference is, or do you see them more of a composite of younger people and you come at it from that angle? How is it that you framed this character so vividly before you began writing?
Yes. So I'm not really sure how to answer that because I don't really know where creativity comes from. So sometimes it just lands in my lap and I just write, right? I'm just sitting at the computer and I have characters speaking to me. I deliberately didn't give this child a gender because it doesn't matter. It's just their perspective on this new thing that's happening to them, this new thing that they're visualizing. And they do see it very oddly. Like nowadays we would know that was a bell, but they don't know that's a bell, right? So they are seeing it. They're seeing this building that nobody lives in. Now what's the point of that? And they can't even move it when it's time to move the ground. So it's a very good perspective, understanding just their perspective and not the non-Indigenous folks on the other side. So I don't really know how to answer that question. It's just creativity comes from that ether above. I'm not really sure where, but I'm grateful it does.
No, definitely. But I think more specifically, what I was wondering is, could you imagine that character? Because I know when I write, I climb into a character and I see everything through their eyes. And I've spoken to many other authors who go, no, I am almost godlike and I am looking down on all my characters as they move around the page. So for you, what I'm trying to establish is, did you picture this character and you could see them looking out at what was happening? Or was it a case of you just climbed into them?
For all my characters, I climb into them. I become them. And I think it's a good way of doing it because I think, okay, if this is me, what am I seeing? What am I thinking? How am I feeling? So a lot of my actual feelings and stuff come across in my writing because I do get into the character. I don't look at them from above. Sometimes I do say that they're in my head speaking to me and telling me things. And that's obviously not the case. But yeah, it's because I am feeling, I am thinking what they're thinking. I am seeing through their eyes. So when I'm writing it, I can see I'm running along the river's edge and watching these people. So yeah, I'm not above. I am the character a lot of the time.
Yeah, I must be honest, I can't imagine writing any other way. But then I recently found out that there's a whole bunch of people, even writers, who don't have inner monologue, who don't have all these thoughts constantly whizzing around their head, and that there are writers who cannot picture an apple in their mind when they're writing a scene about an apple. And that to me is completely fascinating, because when I write, the whole outside world sort of snaps and fizzles into place for me. So I'm always really interested in how other writers approach that. Now, something that we do on our podcast, Amanda, is we have literary agents. We have a Books with Hooks segment, and we say to our listeners, send us your query letters, send us your opening pages so that we can kind of help you polish them up before you send it out to agents, because the market is so competitive and we want them to get their agents and to get published. And often when they begin with characters like this, we'll say, oh, don't do that, because what you are doing is you are giving us so little of this character. You are giving us an observing character who's just sitting there and observing their environment, and we're not getting anything on the character. But you have done this so superbly, but with great intentionality as well, because where the tension in this story comes in is very little happens. If you look at on the page, this isn't even conflict between these two different people. There's no conflict. These people are just arriving. They seem miserable. And it's like, wow, they're wearing crap, heavy, rough clothes. No wonder they're miserable. And why are they miserable? They can't hear the sound of nature, etc. So virtually nothing happens. But the tension in this piece comes from the fact that the reader knows more than this character knows. And this reader knows more than what this character's father knows. And so while the father is busy reassuring this character, we as the reader know, shit, this is bad, right? And so the character can sit and observe, but we still have tons of tension because we know what's going to happen in the future.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them, and that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally. First with words, and then with phrases, and then sentences. And it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Yeah, that's a really good analysis. I don't really think of my writing with a critical lens. I just write it. So that's kind of interesting. It's funny that you mentioned that, because last night I was thinking there's a few of my stories where nothing really happens in this collection, right? Nothing really happens, but I'm hoping that people see what I was trying to do with them. And in this case, we do know what's going to happen. Like, we have this information. A few other stories, nothing really happens, but it's still important to understand the context of what's happening. You know what I mean? So yeah, it's kind of funny that you brought that up when I was thinking about it last night, when I was like, what if people ask me about these stories where nothing really happens?
No, again, so for our listeners, you get confused because we'll read something and we'll go, well, nothing's really happening here. And we need a plot and we need things to happen so that A happens and the dominoes tip over and we know where we're getting, right? So we'll talk about plot and we'll talk about quiet stories. If you're someone who's writing quiet stories, you need to read Waiting for the Long Night, because so many of these are incredibly, incredibly quiet. But that doesn't mean that they are not emotionally weighted. It doesn't mean that there isn't huge tension, because this story is the perfect example of how you can create tension when the reader knows what's coming for them, when the character themselves don't. And Amanda could have chosen a scene in which there was huge confrontation between these two groups of people, but she didn't. Very intentionally, she chose quite an idyllic scene. This child is watching these people. There is sadness. Things are happening, but nothing major is happening. But the whole time there is this simmering tension as you realize that this child is actually right. Their father is actually wrong. And from history, we know that really awful things are going to happen. So if you're writing that kind of quiet story in which nothing happens, say to yourself, how can you create this kind of tension? Why does it matter what's happening on the page, even if there isn't a lot happening on the page? Now, there's a second story that Amanda's written in this collection. I wish we could get you to read all of them and dissect them all, but we don't have time, Amanda. So I'm going to ask you just to read the first few pages of your second story. And then there's a lot that I'd like to break down there as well.
Okay. So the second story in the collection is called Tiny Birds and Terrorists. And I'm just going to read the first couple pages. This is a bit longer one. The last of the night shift has started to fade into the distance. It's time for food and sleep. In the field between us and those dressed for war, a small fire sputters from neglect. We watch the soldiers as they stand in a straight line, blocking the horizon, their face shields hiding their eyes. They shift nervously and look behind them every few minutes. The morning passes this way, their unease sinking into our songs and breaking the rhythm of our chants. We stand side by side, our arms wrapped around each other's waist, singing and praying. Then, just before noon, as we spread food out on blankets in preparation for lunch, a crack forms in the black wall as they part. They arrived 2 days after the television called us terrorists, so many trucks that the ground vibrated under our feet, and the rumbling woke Sisipchich. 10 or 20 at a time, crawling out of the black of military vehicles, large tents erected behind them. 2 straight black lines blocking our way to the road, our access to showers and food. They stand so still, watching us from behind their tinted visors, their hands resting on their batons, ready for a fight that we don't want. They outnumber us 3-1. They carry guns and tasers. We carry drums and songs. Something's wrong. Mala stands and offers her hand to help me up. Sisipjid strapped securely to my back on a cradle board, sleeps through the tension. Mala helps me to my feet just as the nesting birds lift up out of the grass, their bodies moving together, a cloud of birdsong hanging overhead before they bear left, escaping. Opposite us, a few of the men hang their heads. Their chins brush the thick plastic of their chest protectors until the one in charge yells, and they snap their heads back into place. Mala lets go of my hand, breaks away from our group, and moves to the center of the field. "I need to get a closer look," she whisper shouts back to us. I am very aware that I have Mala's baby strapped to my back, the ties crisscrossed over my shoulders and across my chest. The others behind me stop beating and stand, walking towards Mala. The air is breathless in the warm spring morning. Sisipjij jolts awake and begins to cry, frightening those on both sides of the divide, scaring the last of the birds out of the grass. One of the soldiers thrusts his hands up into the air, his black arms silhouetted against the calm prairie sky. When he drops it again, the air is filled with the sound of rushing water. The whoosh of the water cannon drowns out the sound of a crying baby. "You're going back to school," my mother said over supper. "No." "Yes." "No, Jesus, give me time." My fork fell to the table and clanged against the plate. "You're acting like you have a choice here. I'm still your mother, and if you want a place to live and food on your plate, you're going back to school." She paused to take a long drag off her cigarette that hung from the corner of her mouth. "And I'm well aware how long it's been. I loved her too." I ignored her last remark. "You didn't finish school." "Yeah, and look what good it did me, pumping gas and selling lotto tickets. Nothing spells success like the smell of gas on your hands at the end of the day." "I'm not going back." "Fine, become a res bum, but you're not doing it here."
Awesome, Amanda. Thank you so much. So what I want to discuss here is the interplay between scenes, between the present and the past, even in a short story. So we're always saying on the podcast, decide on your tense, whether it's past tense, whether it's present tense, with intentionality. Decide on where you're going to begin very intentionally. So what we have here is, it's a longer short story, but we begin in the action of a moment in the present tense. We end with something terrible happening and we're like, what the hell just happened? And then we go into the past tense, into a much more domestic kind of scene, less high action stuff. And then later we will come back to that present scene with the water cannons, etc. So I refer to finding your beginning as circling a building and trying to find your way in, whether it's the front door, a side window, the chimney, the fourth floor, whatever the case may be, you've got to try and figure out how to approach the story. When you started with the story, is that where you began? Did you write it in a linear time frame and then go, no, I'm going to flash forward to the future? I'd love to understand the evolution of this piece.
Yeah, this piece, and funny, that's the first time I've ever read from this piece. So that was a little bit oof for me. But this piece did not start that way. It did start just linear at first, but I found it kind of dull to begin with. Like, I needed something to draw. I wanted to make sure the reader felt engaged in the story. So having something dramatic and kind of unknown, like what is going on, happen, and then go back and explain how it got to this point and then finish with the end is how I ended up doing it. But that's not how it started at all, because I was just sitting and thinking of how am I going to get the reader engaged and get them to stay engaged in this story. That's how I came up with that first part, which was written after the rest of it was done.
Yeah, and it worked so incredibly well. So again, for our listeners, when you begin somewhere with intentionality, you sometimes feel like you really have to set it up, right? You've got to explain why the character is the way they are, what happened to them, what would make them go on this huge quest and drop everything and go join these people who are being accused of being eco-terrorists. And you feel like you have to give insight into that character to explain their actions. And sometimes you really don't. Sometimes you really want to kind of begin in medias res, in the middle, in the action, put us there and then take us back and have a payoff for the curiosity seed you planted in the beginning. Because what Amanda did there is, as the water cannon opens and suddenly you find in the next thing, this character is mourning. And so she planted a curiosity seed, because you go, did Marla die? Did something happen to the baby, or did something happen to Marla? And this is why this character is in mourning. Oh my goodness, I have to keep reading to find out what happened. And then when you find out what happened, it's a payoff, an intentional payoff to the curiosity seed that was planted early along. Whereas if she'd written that in a very linear timeline, we would not have had a curiosity seed and we would not have had a payoff. So that kind of intentionality with jigsawing a piece around is really important. Does it happen to you a lot, Amanda, when you are busy writing? Or is it a case of this story was very different and this is the one that you had to play around with?
I'm trying to think back to the other stories and if I did that in other stories and I can't remember. But this one I did play around with a lot. This was one of the ones that I worked on and worked on and worked on. But I find I also did that in my novel. I would just leave a little seed at the end of each chapter to make sure you want to come back to that character, because it's a dual POV. So I always kind of want to leave a seed for the reader to keep them interested and to let them know that there's something really interesting coming up. And yeah, if I had written this in linear way, this story would have been very dull and I don't think it would have made this collection. But maybe I do it intentionally and I just don't realize I'm doing it intentionally. But with this one, I definitely did. It was a very conscious decision after I'd written like, I don't know, 5 drafts of the short story and I was still not happy with it. I'm like, we have to start with some tension. Something's got to happen to get the reader, people who are going to engage with the story, interested in the story.
Yeah, for me, so much of the alchemy of writing happens when you've written something and you know it has potential, you know it's important, but you also know it's not working. And it's like, how am I going to get this working without sacrificing the story? Because I'm sure there were other stories that were fighting to get in the collection, and you were like, but this is important and I want it there. But how am I going to up it so that it gets to stay there? And then you get to jigsaw it. And when you find out the solution, I always feel like it's like, oh, yes, I found it. And this is how I get to keep it. So problem solving is a huge part of being a writer. And I don't think we discuss this enough.
Yeah, I agree, because you can be working on something for so long and you know it's almost there, but you just can't get it right. And then there's that aha moment when everything just comes together. And it is problem solving. It is trying to figure out, like, does this make sense in this context? How are other people going to interpret this? How are they going to read it? Am I pleased with it? So it is a lot of problem solving and putting things together. I often use the example of putting a puzzle together when you're writing, because you're just trying to, right now I'm working on a new novel and I have a scene that's just sitting out there, right? I'm like, I know it fits, but I don't know where. So it's like that last puzzle piece, right? And I'm like, it's just sitting at the back of the manuscript with no home yet. So it's like all about putting those things together and understanding how to solve those problems of continuity, of just story itself.
Yeah, I feel like that scene's on the bench and it's just waiting to be called up for its moment to shine, and you'll figure out when its moment is and you'll call it up and it's really going to hit it out the park. Last two questions we have time for, Amanda. One is, I struggle with short stories. I'm a novelist through and through. I really struggle to just give you the snapshot of something. So for you, going from writing a novel to going back to short stories, was that tough for you? Or was it a case of you were always a short story writer, but you got told by agents and publishers you have to write a novel first before you can publish an anthology? How did that work for you?
Actually, none of those. These are all, well, mostly written before I wrote a novel. And these are all written prior to the Berry Pickers, most of them, some of them during the Berry Pickers, when I just needed a break from that story. Because as you would know as a writer, sometimes you just have to put it away and let it rest for a while. The reason is I never thought I could write a novel. I was like, I can't write a novel. That is really hard. And I'm a voracious reader. I love books, right? And I'm like, oh, I could never do something like that. So I would write short stories. And I was always reminded that a short story is difficult because you have to put so much and so little, right? You have to make sure that there are the elements of good writing. There has to be theme. There has to be plot. There has to be something. Even though some of my stories actually nothing happens, there still has to be tension. So it's just kind of hard trying to get those all those things in like 20 pages or under. And some of my short fiction in this collection are flash fiction. So they're under 1,500 words. So it's a really difficult task. But when I wrote The Berry Pickers, which I originally thought was a short story because I thought I could never write a novel, but then other people, not an agent or anyone, just people who read it. Some of my folks in the acknowledgments of the book from the Banff Center for a residency there, like, this is not a short story. This is a book. And everybody kept saying that until I was like, oh, fine, I'll try it and see if I can write a book. I still didn't think I could. But I took the frame of mind that each chapter was a short story. So I was like, okay, if I think that everyone is a short story and something has to happen, and this has to happen, and then it has to have an ending, then maybe I can get my head around it. So I kind of wrote it that way. It's like every chapter is its own individual short story. And then I can just fix the continuity issues and stuff later.
I love the sneakiness there of telling yourself that, because I have a good friend who also started with something that was a short story. And I was like, oh, this is not a short story. This is a novel. And she also said, I can't write a novel. I write poetry and short stories. And I was like, just think of it as a bunch of interconnected short stories. You just got to write one short story after the next. And her book is coming out in April. So that's also amazing to celebrate. Amanda, it's been such a joy chatting with you. For our listeners, we are linking to Waiting for the Long Night Moon. And we'll also link to The Berry Pickers on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get it there, you support an independent bookstore and you support the podcast at the same time. Amanda, it's been such a joy chatting with you. And we can't wait to see what you do next.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been lovely. And I hope everybody who picks it up enjoys Waiting for the Long Night Moon.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamarais.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the 3rd day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.